You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A central presence of Let the Great World Spin, Colin McCann's latest novel, is never mentioned by name. Instead, Philippe Petit, who crossed between the two towers of the World Trade Center on a tightrope on August 7, 1974, is more of a thread who links together the lives of a diverse cast of characters. The book is published by Random House, and Mr. McCann, as you probably know, is the author of two collections of short stories, five other novels. His fiction has been published in 30 languages and has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, GQ, and Paris Review. He's also a professor in the MFA Creative Writing Program at Hunter College, and I'm very pleased that he's made a return visit to our show. Hi.
Hi, it's great to see you.
Now, Philippe Petit's feat, which was crossing between the World Trade Center towers on a tightrope, is mentioned in many of the narratives in your novel, but is this really about Philippe Petit's cross at all?
No, it's not really. I mean, he's the conceit that that ties all these people together on this one sort of fantastic day. He did the walk, as you know, in August 74, 2 days before Nixon resigned, and he strung that tightrope a quarter of a mile in the sky and went back and forth eight times. He lay down on it and he did all these things. But what interested me, it was the great art crime of the 20th century.
Who dubbed it that?
He dubbed it that himself. And he's good at publicity, but in many ways it was, because it was temporary and it was up there, and then you can sort of reimagine him up there.
Were you writing this when Man on Wire, the documentary about his walk, came out?
Oh, that freaked me out, because I'd been working for 2 years on this novel, and then I heard there was a documentary, and I was like, this is the end of it all. I'm going to have to throw this novel away. And I went with great trepidation to the cinema. Seriously, I went early in the morning, you know, so nobody could see me when I came out, you know, tearing the last of my hair out. And I actually came out and felt that it didn't intrude on the territory of the novel at all.
You're probably our leading Irish emigre writer. I don't know how else to describe you. Irish-American doesn't really say it, but you definitely are from Ireland, but you write American books. This seems to be influenced as much by the most American of all writers, John Dos Passos, as any other writer I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge admirer of Dos Passos and Steinbeck and the social novelists who came along and then took all these high angles and then close angles on things. I think Dos Passos had this beautiful sort of cinematic technique with what he did, and he would pull out and then he would get right down to the core of human experience. And I suppose this book tries to take that high angle to look at, for a moment, at Petit, but then it goes right down to the floor of the city.
Well, his book's used, of course, to describe a country, but this book, although you're dealing with the United States, really seems to be more about the diversity of New York City during a time that we were in an awful lot of trouble.
Right. Well, see, the time that we were in an awful lot of trouble almost folds over onto the time when we were in an awful lot of trouble 2 years ago. A city that was about to go bankrupt, an ineffectual president, Nixon, who was about to resign. Issues of technology, you know, the internet was... The first emails, believe it or not, were sent in 1974. There were 64 nodes on what was then called the ARPANET. And these questions of faith and art and technology, they all sort of seemed... And of course, they had Vietnam, the soldiers coming home from Vietnam. And these issues seemed to fold over onto where we are now, and then use the idea of the tightrope as a metaphor, perhaps, mm-hmm. or an allegory or an analogy to 9/11.
Although you never mention 9/11 here.
No.
But it's a presence.
It has to be.
Because you can't
presence.
Talk about the World Trade Towers without thinking 9/11.
Exactly. I mean, the very mention of the word brings it up. But it was only after 9/11, after my own family's experience of 9/11 here in the city, that I thought I have to write about it. But as so many of us have said, at 9/11 there was everything came down. So much came down. Meaning came down. So that you were not sure if you look at a fire hydrant on the street. It seemed intimately connected with everything. Or I remember seeing a dog on its own going across the Brooklyn Bridge, and that was a metaphor for 9/11. Everything, the lack of eye drops on the shelves of the supermarkets, that was a metaphor. And so then, as a writer, you wonder if everything has meaning, if everything's charged that way, how do you go in and find it and talk about it?
So when you started writing this book, were you thinking about writing a 9/11 novel, but didn't want to do anything so crass as to actually write a 9/11 novel?
It's not that it wasn't, it was crass, because I mean there have been some great works of art about 9/11. Think of Don DeLillo, for instance. It was just that I wanted to find a different way to experience it. My father-in-law was in the second building to come down. He got out shortly beforehand, thankfully. But he said to me at one stage, he came up to our apartment, he was covered in dust and it sloshed through all the water at the bottom of the building. And all he remembers was the faces of those young men and women climbing up the stairs as he was coming down and he got out to freedom. And he left his shoes in our apartment because he didn't want to wear those clothes. And he actually took off his suit and he put it in the rubbish, in the garbage. And I looked at those shoes, my wife and I looked at those shoes for weeks afterwards, trying to make sense of them at the door, covered in the dust of the World Trade Center. And finally we said we would keep them, and we still have them in our house. Because I think in those shoes he sort of walked out. And even they were working on the level of metaphor. But what I wanted to try and do, I suppose, was to try and find that moment of grace.
You have an epilogue here that takes place in 2006, so you can deal with some of the things that happened in the aftermath of 9/11, like airport security, the war in Iraq. Why specifically 2006? Is there something you wanted at some point you wanted to make there, or is that just when you were first writing the book?
No, it was the Bush years, and in fact, for me, I mean, it's my own personal little thing. Nobody needs to get this at all, but it was my Obama metaphor. It was in that chapter. There's a young woman, a young black woman, who climbs into bed beside an older white woman, and there's a moment where there is redemption, where everything gets built back up again. Because, I mean, this is something I think that we need to talk about, and it's not, I don't think it's sentimental to talk about healing anymore. For a while it seemed, you know, when we were turning the idea of justice into revenge and we were going abroad to Iraq and Afghanistan, healing didn't seem to be the right sort of word. But now, I don't know how you feel about it, but I feel that we're in a time where we can talk, we can look at it, and we can begin to compute those stories and maybe heal.
Although I'd get emails from people all the time complaining, they seem to think that the statute of limitations has already run out on those discussions.
Oh, they'll never run out. You know, I got to tell the story of, you know, my own son and daughter. I got to tell them someday what happened to their grandfather, what happened to the city on that particular day. Stories don't end.
My guest is Colin McCann. His latest novel is Let the Great World Spin, and it is published by Random House. You've said that you don't like the terms fiction and nonfiction. So, I mean, this is being called a novel, and it right on the cover. How much of it is based on actual fact? Are you one of those people like E.L. Doctorow who uses real names but then makes a lot of the stuff up?
I'm a great fan. He's one of my all time heroes, Mr. Doctorow. Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, we're all storytellers. We all have a story to tell, and this idea that something is true or not. Sometimes what we call fiction can have a greater texture of truth than what we would call nonfiction, because you're not being selective about the facts. I wrote a book called Dancer where I had Rudolf Nureyev at the center of the book, and yet I invented all these characters around him.
In much the same way that you've had Philippe Petit here, although
exactly.
You did use Nureyev's name in Dancer. Here you don't even do that for Petit, although on the cover of the book, we definitely see an image that we associate with Philippe Petit.
There's a beautiful cover on the book. I'd like to talk about that for a second. We commissioned this Italian artist, Matteo Pericoli, to come up with an idea of a city, pulled together by the tension of a tightrope. And I think he did an extraordinary job.
Now, where does the title Let the Great World Spin come from?
Comes from Tennyson, and I was really worried, to be honest, you know, being Irish, and I was worried about, oh my God, I'm taking a line from Tennyson. It's let the great world spin forever.
You mean it had to be William Butler Yeats or nobody?
Oh, sure, yeah. No, but Tennyson, it didn't seem right to me at first, but it was a beautiful line. Let the great world spin forever down the ringing grooves of change. As I started to study it, I realized that he had studied these Arabic poems, pre-Islamic Arabic poems, called the Mulaqat, or the suspended poems. And it seemed to me, so this is all working in a Yeatsian gyre, if you will.
Can we talk a bit about these different narrators? Some are in first person, some are in third person. You change your styles with different ones. In some cases, dialogue has quotes around it, and others you just have dashes. And
right.
In a style that I associate with James Joyce, you didn't use quotes in Dancer, so
right.
You've used that technique before. But I think why be inconsistent in that way?
I think every voice finds its form on the page, and it tells you how to write it. Like, I have a voice of a 38-year-old prostitute in the Bronx, a grandmother in the Bronx, and I worked, I'll be honest, I worked for like months and months and months trying to get her voice, and I couldn't get it because I was trying to write traditional narrative. And then suddenly one night she sort of whispered in my ear this line. It's a sort of throwaway line. It's like, the skinniest dog I've ever seen is on the side of the Greyhound buses.
Mm-hmm.
And then once she said that to me, I realized what her voice was and how she spoke. And so she doesn't speak in traditional ways.
That's, you're talking about Tilly.
Tilly.
Her daughter is also a prostitute named Jaslyn. But you have an Irish monk here. You have a woman from the Upper East Side. A black woman from the Bronx. Again, as an emigre, as somebody who's come to the city, more aware of the diversity than others might be.
I don't think I'm more aware of it than others, but it's a Whitman poem. I mean, I look around the city and I walk around, the Upper East Side or Queens or Brooklyn, and I think I'm in the middle of this grand narrative. 8 million souls sort of clashing and colliding, and everybody with a story to tell. I mean, I have to say, I adore this city in all its dirt and filth and everything.
And yet, you weren't here when this novel takes place. You spent a summer here in 1984, if I remember correctly.
That's
and
correct.
Then returned in 1994.
Right. I was a real youngster when I came when it came first. I actually lay down on the Avenue of the Americas, because I couldn't fathom how tall those buildings were. I'd never come from Dublin. The tallest building in Dublin was 16 stories. And I sort of fell in love with it, the city, and this is my home now. You asked me earlier, what am I? I'd say I'm an Irish New Yorker.
But you also spent some time in Japan.
Yeah.
That didn't wind up keeping you?
No, and I haven't even really written about Japan. I go back and forth to Ireland all the time, so it's still... James Joyce, he said, I've been so long out of Ireland that I can all at once hear her voice in everything. So a part of me feels that I'm away because I want to go home.
Well, I remember speaking to one emigre writer, the late José Donoso, who had lived in exile in Madrid for many years because of the Pinochet regime, and he couldn't stay there. And Santiago, Chile, was the most beautiful city in the world until he was allowed to return. He realized that it wasn't everything he had fantasized.
Isn't it Brodsky who says you can't go back to the country that doesn't exist anymore? And I go back to Ireland, and it's a completely different. Have you been to Ireland in recent years?
No.
Oh, it's changed so spectacularly from what it was when I left. I don't want to have that sort of nostalgic, or what the Portuguese call the saudade. It's a beautiful word.
It'll always be the sight of the ginger man for me.
Colin
McCann is the... that was a young fantasy. Colin McCann is the internationally best-selling author of the novel Zoli, Dancer,
This Side?
This Side of Brightness and Song Dogs, and now Let the Great World Spin, which is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.